has a child, you know, naked, and himself naked, and essentially has sexual intercourse with them without penetration because the child's not large enough for the person to penetrate. But for the child, it's just like they're raped, but it doesn't fall within, it's not attempted rape because he's not trying to penetrate, but it's the same act as far as a child's concerned. And a large number of our cases involve that and or masturbation of the offender. And I think a lot of times when we think about the definition of sexual conduct under sex abuse in the first degree, we're thinking of a fondling of the breasts or genitals by the offender. Sometimes it's much more aggravated than that kind of conduct. The second thing, and I think there's somebody here from the correctional treatment program who will testify about this in a little more detail, but to complete their program, I believe you have to be 2 to 2.5 years from release. And since the sex abuse in the first degree people are less than that, the only way they can get in the program is if they're willing to extend their time in the penitentiary, and very few offenders are going to want to do that. So the result is that they don't get treatment, and hopefully they'll speak to us a little bit, but these offenders have many, many victims, and pedophiles are sort of like alcoholics in as much as the idea is now that they're never cured. They're always going to be sexually aroused by children. The idea is to contain their behavior so they don't act out. But for those reasons, I think it's real important to increase the potential amount of time they can serve.
Questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We have
only a comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
One pedophile national statistic identified in excess of 3,000 victims, just one.
Let's have Mr. Jones. Come on up, Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I missed that one on the agenda today, so I don't have copies of testimony, but I would certainly, as an individual and a member of the parole board, sit in support of the proposed legislation.
Yeah, why don't you identify yourself for the record? And
all right. I'm Chalmers Jones, member of Board of Parole. And I feel constrained to support this legislation. I've been jumping up and down about it around the state for a number of years, simply because I think that the equating of that as Mr. Collins said, with the things that a normal class C felons are felonies, to me almost approaches what might be called a travesty. Now, there are some things that I really should clear up in Mr. Collins' testimony, such as the parole board controls crowding at the prison. That simply is not the case. We're not in the business of controlling populations until the legislature says we should do that, and I understand there's legislation to do that. I just want to be brief in that we see an inordinate amount of cases of sex abuse. Normally, you are talking at a person that really has a high history risk score, somewhere above 9. Some have never had a conviction before for anything. And they have been nice people in the community until they've been found out. I think the other thing that concerns me, as has been said by those who testified before me, about the actual existence of rape. Now, it is not uncommon to actually have sexual penetration or, in effect, rape. I think a lot of this is negotiated away. Or there is the situation of pleading guilty to the lesser included offense in order not to put the child through the trauma of testifying in an open court, and there may be some merit to that. But as a result of that approach, absolutely too many serious sex offenders are falling through the cracks. Even if the individual has a 2.5 year minimum and it is imposed upon him for the purpose of letting him get into the treatment programs at CTP, the volume of people needing the program or the capability of the program in terms of beds makes it almost impossible. So I think that, and I would not say only for that reason, but I think that's one of the supporting reasons that I have, there is a need for a greater penalty simply because I think the crime requires that. And secondly, if treatment is available, a longer penalty, a reclassification of that crime to a Class B felony would certainly make treatment a lot more possible than it is now. I think we're talking about, oh, 1 in 10 maybe now that can get into the program because of the backlog.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hicks.
Have you followed up on the treatment program, how successful it's been as far as recidivism rates after they've gone through the
program? Senator Hendrickson, we don't have the capability to do the stats. The Corrections Division does, and I think they could furnish those. I think for those who complete the program, there are benefits to be derived. However, in this group of people, you have a lot of sexual psychopaths. They're untreatable, really. So what we're doing is whistling down a rain barrel when we take up a bed in a very limited program for a sexual psychopath. They like to gravitate to the program if they can get in. Of course, the screening process is rather good on this. But it's reduced custody. Life is a lot easier. But the stats can be furnished. I simply do not have them.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Jones? All right, Mr. Jones, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ron Wall, please.
I'm Ron Wall. I'm a therapist at the Oregon State Hospital Sex Offender Program at CTP.
Now, can I
interrupt?
By that, now, a therapist, meaning what's your educational background and your degrees and your certification, if any, and so forth?
Okay, I've got a master's degree. I've been at the Oregon State Hospital since 1979, the inception of the program, sex offender program, and correctional treatment programs. I'm a certified behavioral therapist at the state hospital. I work with particularly behavioral treatment and assessment of the sexual offenders there.
Where did you go to school? Excuse me? Where did you get your degree?
I got an undergraduate degree from BYU, Brigham Young University of Hawaii campus, and a master's at the University of Arizona.
Mr. Chair, Senator Simmons, before we start, what's the CTP?
Oh, correctional treatment programs.
Thank you.
There's 4 of them at the state hospital.
How many of you are there in this program?
We have bed space for 33 in our particular program. We have...
But I mean, how many therapists are there?
How many therapists?
For 33.
We have a staff online, not just therapists, but we have also line staff. We have a unit director. We have 2 group therapists. We have, I think, 4 behavioral therapists. I'm one of those. We have several other line staff. We have an RN, nurse. We have a part-time recreational therapist. We have other staff that we're sharing with other units, such as a psychologist and educational specialist.
But the 6 therapists are working with the 33 in this program, is that it?
Right.
Oh, great.
We have, as mentioned, approximately a 2.5-year program inpatient where the individual comes in program and stays there from 2 to 2.5 years inpatient. Then he'll transition in the community and live in the community, but come back and return to continue his treatment process to group sessions and so on. And that'll continue for another 18 months while he's on parole in the community. For those, I believe, that have completed both inpatient and outpatient, I don't think we've had any recidivism at this point. Some statistics that we've gotten at the program that we've recently completed here.
Excuse
for
me.
Child molesters, we have an average age of 15 at the start of their first offense. We have, at the time of their first arrest, an average age of 28, mm-hmm. almost twice as old as when they first started. Another 13 years of offending after their first offense on an average.
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Did I hear you say, since that you have no statistics showing any kind of recidivism rate for any of those inmates that have gone through both in and outpatient treatment? Is that what I heard you say? And if so, for how long a period of time have you followed these inmates? How can you, I guess, validation for your statement, please?
Validation is that we have, and we're still in the process of gaining that data.
So you can't really say.
No, it's difficult
that's
at
what
this
I wanted
point.
To know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I try to qualify that, that as best as my knowledge is. And we don't have really a method for following except perhaps a visit for that individual. We don't have at this point a method for us to continue. This person is in no obligation to continue contacting us after 18 months after outpatient. And so it is rather difficult to continue following.
The treatment that you speak of is behavioral aversion therapy?
Or well, we have several methods of treatment. We have group therapy.
I guess that's what I wanted to know, the kind of therapy you're using regarding the inmates that you say you have followed thus far.
Sure. We have group therapy, which is probably the most that they receive. On an average of 25 to 26 hours a week, they're in groups, structured groups. They also have educational modules or components or classes that they attend to cover various areas of social skills and living skills. They also have, as you mentioned, aversion therapy, other types of modalities of to reduce deviant sexual arousal or interest in deviant things and deviant stimuli. We also have kind of a cognitive therapy, if you will, you want to call it that. Some call it Salmonellian criminal thinking error type of therapy. Follow cognitive
what's
or thinking.
What's the first word there?
Cognitive.
Something.
Salmonell?
Yes, all right. Thank you. Excuse me, I apologize.
Stanton Salmonell and Yokelson wrote a series of books on criminal personality.
How do you spell it,
man?
S-A-M-N-E-N-O-W.
Right. So those are primary methods of, we also, in addition to that, I might add, we have chemotherapy in terms of Depo-Provera, which has been used on a very limited basis. Pretty much as almost a last resort, as individuals still have high deviant sexual interest or arousal to deviant themes, we have used Depo-Provera with some success. Again, too, does that
I was just
teach your question on the components of treatment?
You made such a broad, almost gross generalization. I just had to.
Okay.
Did
that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Henderson.
If you're doing a treatment, I mean, I can't understand that you wouldn't have put in place some kind of follow-up, because how are you ever going to know how successful these are if you don't have a system to follow these people after they're put back in the community?
We have basically followed the therapies that have fairly well success rates around the country and adopted those models from both private as well as public treatment facilities, and they have much better follow-ups than we have, and so we're basing right now our statistics on them pretty much. We do not have.
I just find that astounding. I mean, you could say, you can't call it a statistic. I mean, you could say this treatment has this kind of success rate someplace else, but I don't see how you could use that as your statistic.
No, I didn't say it was. I didn't quote any statistics regarding any success rate. I just mentioned that as best we can follow the individuals we've had contact beyond 18-month
period.
They
get contact with the criminal justice system again. Do you have some statistical way that you are informed if they are adjudicated again for sex offense? That you will have some way.
Yes, we do.
If they are
rearrested, yes, we do have some way to get that information. If they're not arrested, we don't have that information necessarily.
So at least with arrest records, of the people that have gone through your program to date, none of them have been rearrested from what you can find out?
That I'm aware of.
And how long, when did you first start putting people out of this program?
We began putting them out approximately 1982, I believe.
Okay, so in 2 years, at this point, you haven't had a rearrest of one of your people.
Right.
Pardon, Mr. Chairman, how many of them are out there?
We have currently in outpatient, I think, about a dozen or so right now. It's always going to be less than the inpatient because it's a shorter period of time.
That doesn't answer the question that I thought he was asking, and if he was not,
How many graduates besides those you have in
the
database
now? Oh, okay. How many graduates? I don't have that data with me today. So I can't really answer that.
Hundreds? Tens?
Probably tens, yeah. It's not a large amount.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Hickson?
How do you select what people will be put in your program?
The selection process is done through interview and through referral from the OSCI institution in OSP. Their correctional counselors can refer them. They can be referred through, they can write for treatment themselves. Upon those referrals, we interview those individuals and screen them if they're deemed appropriate for our program.
What is your criteria?
They have to be somewhat literate. They have to have a desire or motivation for treatment as expressed, and not have, let me say that before I go any further, we do have a couple of other programs at the Oregon State Hospital and correctional treatment programs that deal with slightly different types of clients that have different problems, that have maybe more severe problems.
I was interested in your sex offender program at this point. What's your criteria?
Okay. We try to screen out those that have severe handicaps, either mentally, emotionally, or learning disabilities.
And what about sexual status? I understood that you didn't take those in your program.
That is correct. We have some screening for that, although we have taken a couple of them. We do have currently two murderers in our program.
And so do you try to screen out the obviously sociopathic?
We do try to screen out the more obvious ones.
Okay. Go ahead. You were telling us that the average age at the beginning, offender is about 15, and the guy caught me is 26 or something like
28.
That. 28. Yeah.
The average arrest for our child molesters is about 1.5 arrests. Prior arrests, excuse me. The average arrest for a group of rapists is about 1 and almost 2 arrests, about 1.86 arrests, prior arrests. The offenses that our group has committed, the number of crimes, and we have a number of 53. The group is 53 men that these statistics are on.
Is this a male syndrome? I mean, are there women that are defending the same category?
Androgen poisoning.
It is, at this today, primarily male committed crimes, although more and more we're discovering that women have committed these crimes, and whether that's on the increase, we're not sure at this point. I think initially we feel that it's something about, in terms of being discovered more and being reported. One of the problems with males reporting having been molested, for instance, male victims, is the stigma that is attached for being molested, particularly if they're molested by another male, the feeling that they may be homosexual, etc. And so that's been one of the problems for male victims in reporting their victimizations. The other thing, if a male, young male, is molested by an older woman, frequently the society has felt in the past that this has been a helpful learning experience for this young man rather than an actual victimization. I think that may have affected the reporting also. But for the offenses that our 53 men have committed, they have committed 391 rapes, 6,210 child molestation. This is on self-report. This is not on any legal document. They have committed 2,950 acts of exhibitionism, 12,655 acts of voyeurism, 556 obscene phone calls, 2,995 acts of frottage or rubbing up against people in public places, for a total of 25,757 crimes, sexual crimes. Average just under 400, just under 500 crimes per person. The victims.
Sneaky.
quite. The victims of the child molesters, female victims, I have some data on that. Victims age 0 to 5, there have been 61 reported victims from our group. From ages 6 to 12, 221 reported female victims. From ages 13 to 17, 48 reported victims, for a total of 330 female victims. Male victims, from 0 to 5, age 0 to 5, 26 victims. From ages 6 to 12, 443 victims. From ages 13 to 17, 48 victims, for a total of 517. A little more than the female victims.
Apparently, from what I heard there, the age of interest drops rather rapidly after 12, doesn't it, as far as victims is concerned?
Well, the primary age is from 6 to 12. The most victims, both male and female, are found in the 6 to 12 age range is for our group.
Mr. Chairman, with that in mind, in the Senate Bill 260, which I guess is the subject before us, we've got a line 20. They've increased the age of the victim to 14 from current 12. Can you give me the rationale for increasing the age? Obviously, broadens the scope of the victim class.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that. And there's no sharp cutoff in that. You feel we'll cover the victim group adequately?
I think that would more adequately cover the victim group, yes.
Thank you.
I have information some statistics on a study done by Gene Abel, formerly of New York, now Atlanta. And he, on a group of exhibitionists, he studied, which numbered 142, he noticed quite a number of different diagnoses for that group besides exhibitionism. Clinically, exhibitionists don't seem to be rather terrible folks. It's not a hands-on type of an offense. Yet, from these individuals that he studied, he found that 46% had molested female children outside the home. 22% had molested male children outside the home. 22% had molested female children inside the home. 25% had raped female women, adult women. And 28% had participated in voyeuristic activities. So that they had a number of different other activities besides exhibitionism that they had been involved in. For a group of female child incest offenders, which numbered 159, 49% had molested female children outside the home. Now these are offenders that had molested, been arrested for, convicted of crimes inside the home. 49% had molested outside the home. 12% had molested young males outside the home. 12% had molested young males inside the home, with 19% having raped adult women. One final statistic from Dr. Abel. He had evaluated two different groups. One is the group of adolescent offenders, all under 18. They averaged 1.9 paraphilias apiece, which is to say that they were involved in approximately two different types of sexual deviant behavior. They had an average almost seven victimizations or crimes per offender. He compared that to a group of adult offenders, all adults, and all who had begun their offending prior to age 18. With this group, he found that they had about the same paraphilias or two paraphilias, or they had been involved in approximately two sexually deviant behaviors, types of behavior. But for the victimizations or amount of crimes per offender, had jumped to a whopping 380 per offender.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman. Have you studied, you know, one of the things that bothers me is it seems like we do so little for our adolescent sex offenders, and those are probably the population or try to that would be most effective. You know, when you see someone that's been engaging in deviant behavior for 13 years before they get into any kind of treatment system, it's a little difficult to think you're going to have a lot of luck in terms of. And has there been much done in terms of identifying those young people that are at risk of becoming sexual offenders and any development of adolescent or juvenile programs or interventions so we don't, before they get down this path?
That's a very good question. These statistics point out that the offending has begun much earlier than when they've been caught. And why not try to find them at a much earlier age? And I wholeheartedly agree with that idea. Currently, we do have an adolescent offender network in the state of Oregon where professionals around the state can get together, exchange ideas, and meet both public and private professionals. As for treatment programs, there are some in community-based programs around the state. The state-based programs in the state hospital as well as in McLaren still have a lot of development to go in terms of increasing their ability to treat the offender. What we find in most of those programs, I think, well, in both programs, state hospital and McLaren, the sex offenders are put together with the other types of offenders, and they're not separated, which is one of the things we find that is very, very helpful when you separate one type of offender from another so you can treat his deviant area versus putting them together and having a group that has different types of offenses. The professionals find that is much harder to treat. One type of offender if he's mixed in with others.
Okay, we're going to move along now here.
Mr. Chair.
Necessary questions, sir?
Only a quick comment for Senator Hendrickson's benefit. I think we have one model program, do we not, in the state, right in Washington County at St. Mary's. Again, it's our system of priorities and where we decide to spend our funds. I was told only at noon today the state contributes an entire $55 a day for the treatment program. That includes board, room, treatment, et cetera.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 260 and turn to Senate Bill 552. Dave Frommeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Dave Frommeyer, Attorney General representing the Department of Justice, and here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 552. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe that you have, in essence, heard my testimony on this measure already in conjunction with another bill dealing with videotape testimony. The committee is more than aware, and I think I'd be intruding on your patience as well as on your knowledge of all of the issues of child abuse, of the victimization and re-victimization again in the courtroom and the courtroom proceedings of people who are subject to and the victims of child abuse. For that reason, we have adapted concepts which are now being utilized in other states on a pioneering basis to allow videotape testimony by a child under the age of 12 in civil proceedings. By so limiting the provision, we do not intend to say that it would not be very useful to have these also in criminal proceedings, but simply because of the problems we have with the Confrontation Clause and other constitutional issues. In a criminal case, we have limited this to civil proceedings, which would include juvenile court proceedings. It goes at least part of the way, and we're confident that it satisfies any of the constitutional dimensions that might be presented. I think the committee is well aware of the problem of harassment of child victims by the perpetrators of the crimes when they confront them in the courtroom on an individual basis, of the fact of the trauma that creates. This is one measure which is carefully crafted in order to reduce that trauma while in no way depriving a defendant of the right to elicit whatever evidence or testimony is necessary either on direct examination or cross-examination. We certainly urge you to act expeditiously on the bill.
Was this this bill patterned after another state law?
In essence, it is sui generis. We have looked very closely at the state of Kentucky, which has a law that applies both to civil and criminal proceedings and which has passed constitutional tests in that state. Their constitution, however, has been construed differently than our state constitution, Senator Frye.
Has there ever been a constitutional
issue raised? Well, let me ask you this first. Are there other states in which these proceedings are permissible in civil cases?
In civil cases? I don't offhand have a list, Senator Frye. I can provide that to the committee after further study.
Then you wouldn't be aware, obviously, of any constitutional decision on that.
No, most of the constitutional arguments have been raised in the context of a criminal case because of the obvious extra rights that a criminal defendant has.
Any questions of the Attorney General?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brown?
Can this be used in any collateral matter in a criminal proceeding? For example, impeachment, corroboration, or past recollection recorded, anything like that?
I believe not, Senator Brown. This is because of the wording of Section 2, where we say in any proceeding other than a criminal action.
I just gathered. There's nothing
coming in the back door in the criminal proceeding.
Right.
Not, as I say, because it wouldn't necessarily be salutary, but we don't want to give the committee something that may be constitutionally offensive.
Well, of course, the argument, I suppose, could be made that the use for impeachment